Blog Talk Radio.
Lee Oswald has been shot.
That was the scene on November 24th, 1963, as Lee Harvey Oswald was shot down and killed by Jack Ruby, a mere 2 days after being nabbed as the prime suspect in the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. That incident sparked a debate that has nagged at the soul of this country for more than 40 years, a debate that filmmaker Robert Stone explores in his new documentary, Oswald's Ghost. This is Movie Geeks United, and we will be talking to Mr. Robert Stone in just a few minutes about his extraordinary new film. And also on the show tonight, a complete 180, the composer of Alvin and the Chipmunks, Christopher Lenertz. My name is Jamie. I'm one of your co-hosts for the evening, and Jerry's here with us, too. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, how's everything going?
How's everything been the past couple of days for you?
It's been okay, man. You know, up and down, but you know, excited about tonight. You know how it is.
You sound like you got your feet propped up, like you're all relaxed. It's been fine, man. It's been good.
No, I can't say I have my feet propped up because I don't have anywhere to prop them, unfortunately.
Right. You are manning our chat room now.
Yes,
and if
I am.
If you're listening on the live feed here, feel free to log on to our chat room. You can converse with other listeners about anything that's taking place on the show or about films in general. We have a great show for you tonight, and I encourage everyone to look at our archive of past shows as well, because we've had some great guests recently. We just welcomed the director and the star of the upcoming Star Wars-inspired film Fanboys, and the screenwriter, James Vanderbilt, the screenwriter of Zodiac, which is one of this year's best movies.
Yes, it is.
2007's best movies.
Yeah.
And last week we welcomed John Sayles to the show.
Yeah, I mean, everyone's been on here.
And you know what? This Friday we have a special show because we're part of a press junket for Dolph Lundgren. Dolph Lundgren.
You're going solo. You've got Dolph Lundgren, man. You got.
I could take him on my own, I guess. But did you know that John Sayles wrote a Dolph Lundgren film?
Yeah, Men of War, right?
Yeah, Men of Honor? Was it Honor
Men
or War?
Men of War, I think. It was like he wrote it, and I think it was one of those like scripts they had dug up or something. But I remember watching that.
Well, I guess I have to get the title straight before I interview him.
Yeah, no, I think it's Men. I want to say Men of War or.
Yeah, something. It's definitely got Men in the title. Yeah,
and War, I think too.
Something, either Honor or War. Something that comes with War.
You know what? I'll look it up later.
We'll figure it out. We'll get a hold on that by the end of the show. All right, you ready to get started?
Yeah, definitely ready.
Okay, if anyone wants to call in and ask a question of any of our guests, the number to dial is 718-508-9477. Or you can just submit your questions through the chat room if you're too shy to talk on the radio, and we understand that. Don't we, Jerry?
Oh, you know, all too well.
All right, let's get this thing started. Robert Stone is an Emmy and Oscar-nominated documentary filmmaker whose remarkable credits include Radio Bikini, American Babylon, and Gorilla, The Taking of Patty Hearst. In his new film, Oswald's Ghost, Mr. Stone transcends the hundreds of books, articles, and additional media devoted to dissecting the Kennedy assassination by taking a clear-eyed look at the elusive figure of Lee Harvey Oswald, and in the process, asking larger questions like, why has our obsession with conspiracy only intensified after more than four decades? And what is it about the possibility of conspiracy that give the people of our nation a more viable means of grappling with our grief? This fascinating and beautifully constructed film features thought-provoking insights from the likes of Mark Lane and Norman Mailer and presents a surprising amount of never-before-seen or heard footage, all coming together to create a vivid portrait of one of the most defining moments of the 20th century. It is a great pleasure to welcome to our program Mr. Robert Stone. Mr. Stone, let me see. Mr. Stone, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. That was quite an introduction.
Well, thank you. We're honored that you...
I don't know how to follow that.
Well, we could just end it now if you'd like.
I'm just holding on to Alvin and the Jetbox at this point.
Great honor to have you on.
It really is. I'm crazy about your movie.
Thank you.
Let's open it up. Let's talk about where you were when Kennedy was assassinated. You were 5 years old when the assassination took place, right?
I was 5 years old, and my family had just emigrated here from England, so I'd only been in the country about 3 months. So this was like my first, impression of coming to America, and it left quite an impression, I can tell you.
Oh yeah. In terms of conspiracy over the years, which side of the fence have you generally fallen on, and did that perception change as you embarked on this documentary?
You know, I don't know. I don't remember being that obsessed with this one way or another. I mean, like I said, I was 5 years old when Kennedy was killed. I was really probably more traumatized by what happened in 68 with Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. And, I mean, the story of this film is like the story of my life in some ways. I mean, and a lot of people who came of age in that time frame were... The first time I was aware of a president, there was somebody called the president, and he gets shot, and then there were riots and demonstrations and two more assassinations and Watergate, and this is just the world we were born into. And then all these questions about, well, is there some larger sort of hand behind all of this? That never really penetrated my thinking until... Oliver Stone's film came out in 91, and I was just amazed at the reaction that film got, both in the media and in the public, that this was such an open wound still.
Yeah.
And this effort to sort of explain the whole 1960s through this assassination and everything that had happened to us as a country, I felt like nobody had ever really explored that. Mm-hmm. As a subject. Well, I mean, I think at that point I decided, this is a long time ago, that I wanted to make a documentary about this. And I was totally open to there being a conspiracy. I thought, Oliver Stone's version of it was a little over the top, but I was, and I read all the, nobody can read all the books.
There are hundreds.
But I read most of the major ones, and you read these books, and like, oh my God, it all makes total sense. And then you read another one, that makes sense. But if that makes sense, then the other one can't make sense.
Yeah.
And you go on and on like this, and at a certain point, I became convinced that in all likelihood, Lee Harvey Oswald had acted alone, really almost as a process of elimination.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested in first of all, and I want to explore the content of your film, but in terms of your process as a documentary filmmaker, obviously it's a huge time commitment when you embark on a project like this. So how long did this project take to come together?
Well, if you think that I came up with the idea in 92 or so.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no, in actual making the film... It was about 2 years, but I was fully funded when I got started. So, usually when you hear stories of documentary filmmakers taking 5 years, 10 years to make a movie, which, I've gone through that process as well, a lot of that has to do with not being funded. So,
do you go in with an outline, or does it kind of come together organically?
Well, in this particular case, I was having lunch in London with Nick Fraser, who's the head of BBC Documentaries, and I literally had half a sentence out of my mouth. He was asking me what I wanted to do next. I had, I'd uttered about four words, and he totally got what I was doing and said, "Mailer?" I said, "Yeah." We were just on the same wavelength, and he said, "I'm in." And then I went to PBS, and they got it, almost as quickly. and, you know, I was off and running.
Yeah, you have to tell me about Mailer. Obviously, he spent some of the better part of 5 years working on his book on Oswald. What did you take from your experience sitting down and conversing with Mr. Mailer? This had to have been one of his last kind of.
I think it was. I think he's done. There were some public appearances that he made that, you know, I've seen on videotape on YouTube,
right,
and stuff. But I think I was the last person to actually do a formal sort of.
I think you are.
Yeah.
No, it was totally crazy. I mean, first of all, just getting in to see Mailer was like getting an appointment with the Pope. It took like a year, you know, to get an hour with him. And with various negotiations back and forth with agents, and he's got, you know, this wall of people around him because, I mean, so many people want to get to him. And I always over-prepare for interviews, you know, I read and I know that Mailer doesn't suffer fools, so, you know,
right.
I didn't want to be sitting there asking a stupid question.
So
I read, you know, absolutely everything he'd ever written and, like, had reams of notes and questions and, you know, footnotes and God knows what, you know. And we get to his house out in Provincetown, and his wife met us and his assistants, and they lead us upstairs to a bedroom where we sort of set everything up. And at the appointed hour, the great man arrived, and he was very pleasant, sat down, and chatted a little bit, and we got started. And I think I asked him in a couple of questions, and he just basically held forth and talked about what he wanted to talk about.
Wow.
And answered absolutely every question I could ever have imagined I wanted to ask him perfectly. And then at the end of 45 minutes said to me, I think we're done. If we go any further, it's just going to mess up the editing. And he was right.
Was he really?
He was right.
As you can imagine, he
nailed it. And, you know, yeah.
As you can imagine, I mean, he's perfectly eloquent.
Well, the thing about Mailer, he's one of the few writers who can actually, he can actually talk the way he writes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, most writers, you know, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, you know, you read a book by some writer and it's just like beautifully eloquent and wonderful, and then you actually meet the guy who wrote it and they're kind of inarticulate, you know?
Yes.
Because they sit down and they're writers, you know? They sit down and they really labor over a sentence and get it just right. Well, Mailer's just one of these rare beings who can just talk.
Yeah,
in this
yeah.
wonderful way, so which is why he's such a sought-after person for Dr.
It was a joy to hear him talk, too. But much like Mr. Mailer, I mean, you came to the conclusion that, like you said, Oswald turned out to be the perfect person to commit this murder. Give me a sense of what you discovered about him that led you to that conclusion. Obviously, there's more than meets the eye. It's not just the low nut theory. He has a pretty
checkered path. Oswald's really one of the most fascinating people of the 20th century. I mean, in his 24 years, he packed in a hell of a lot, and he's almost sort of a one man Cold War. You know, he's sort of this dark American nightmare of the Cold War. And, you know, he ran away from his mother. He was coming from a broken home, ran away from his mother, joined the Marines underage, lied to get into the Marines, lied to get out of the Marines, defected to the Soviet Union, which like hardly anybody did in those days. He was first Marine in American history ever to defect the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
Was allowed to stay in the Soviet Union, was given a job, married, then decided he didn't like the Soviet Union, came back to the United States.
Which takes a very resourceful person.
Yeah, and had these grandiose, I think he was probably, I mean, in today's world, he'd probably be diagnosed as bipolar. I mean, he was sort of border, you know, he vacillated from delusions of grandeur to that he was going to, you know, go to Cuba and become Castro's, you know, foreign minister to, you know, absolute depressive suicide. And he did try to kill himself when he was in Russia. But anyway, he came back. His life was pretty miserable. He saw himself as being this person who was going to have this great place in history. He had bought a rifle and had set himself up to be a revolutionary and an assassin, which hence the famous backyard photo with him holding a copy of militant and daily worker, I think, and holding his rifle all dressed in black
right.
that his wife took. He tried to assassinate a very famous right-wing extremist named General Edwin Walker. He missed, was never busted for it.
Wasn't this, this was pretty shortly
before the...
He threatened
to kill Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
Apparently threatened to blow up FBI headquarters in Dallas a couple of weeks before the assassination because the FBI was trying to talk to his wife. So, you know, in many ways, this guy is well, fascinating, and also is almost the perfect person to have single-handedly carried out an assassination of the president. And if you want to know why there's a cover-up, the cover-up is that both the CIA and the FBI knew all about him and knew where he worked and did nothing. And they covered their tracks. And the fact that they covered their tracks has sort of led people to believe that they were somehow involved.
Well, the conspiracy legacy kind of lives on because obviously, I mean, it would have been the greatest trial of the century had he lived to be on trial, as Norman Mailer puts it in your film. But
mm-hmm.
what do we know about Jack Ruby and kind of, I know you cover in your film, but the circumstances surrounding his presence at the police station that day?
Well, I don't want to give people an impression that my film is like, you know, setting out to debunk the conspiracy theories, because it really isn't.
Right.
Although I do come down firmly on the side that I don't think they add up. And I have very good reasons for saying that. My purpose isn't to set out and debunk them, but if you ask about Ruby, let's talk about Ruby. If there was a conspiracy, it does sort of hinge on the idea that Ruby killed Oswald
mm-hmm.
to silence him, right?
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
If
yeah.
not that, then, I mean, if Oswald hadn't been killed, we probably wouldn't be discussing this subject now. But Ruby could not possibly have known when Oswald was going to appear where he did, unless he was in cahoots with the head of the Dallas Police Department. So So if there was a conspiracy with if Ruby was part of a conspiracy to kill Oswald, the timing of it would have to have been coordinated by the Dallas police and members of Dallas police. So you're already getting into a conspiracy with hundreds of people carrying out embarrassing episode in the history of the Dallas Police Department.
But this is, and perhaps I viewed it wrong. But this is in your film. It shows that they were broadcasting that Ruby would be brought out about 10 a.m. that morning.
That's right.
Oswald, I'm sorry. And
right.
and Ruby had sent a telegram and had seen a commotion at the police station around 11 o'clock, and that's about the time they were bringing him out.
Right.
He left
he
his
was,
dogs.
He had gone downtown to send a telegram, and there's records of that, and it's all stamped and dated and everything. He sent a telegram. He's across the street at the Western Union office. At people are going to kill me for being off by a few minutes.
It's,
I think it was 11.
It's close to 11. Yeah.
So this is half an hour after everyone had expected Oswald to be moved. And then he saw the commotion across the street. He knew all these cops. He was buddies with all the cops. He ran a strip joint there, and they all knew him.
Right.
His first comments after shooting Oswald was saying, "Hey, you know me. I'm Jack Ruby." So he waltzed right in, and he was right there. I mean, it's no great surprise. Everybody said, well, why would he do that? You know, it's no great surprise. Probably everybody in America wanted to kill Oswald. Now, how many Americans, had they been a few feet from Oswald with a loaded .45, wouldn't have gone and shot him?
It wasn't
a great surprise.
People that say that it was premeditated... he left his prize, you know, he had his dogs in his car.
Yes, see, that's another. Character is king. He had his dog was his life. He didn't really have any close companions in his life, but he had
right.
this wonderful dog who he took everywhere. He went into the Western Union office and left his dog in the car and then walked across the street so he saw this commotion in the police department and went and shot Oswald. Now, had he been planning to kill Oswald and knowing that he wasn't going to come back, would he have left his dog in the car?
Right.
Well, I don't think so.
Yeah, me too. But still 70% of Americans think believe it's a conspiracy. And why do you think it offers them a sense of comfort in a way to know that it isn't as simple as just one insignificant guy wiping out the leader of the free world?
Well, I'm sure there's an element of that. I mean, I think that's a great many of very, very smart people and close friends of mine who I have tremendous respect for believe that there was a conspiracy to kill Kennedy. In part, what this film is about is to explain why these ideas are so prevalent and
right.
You know, how they came about, who propagated them, why were they so widely accepted, and what have they done to us? So that's it's not difficult to understand why there was why people believe in the conspiracy, because there probably were conspiracies to kill Kennedy. I'm sure there were. I mean, how many people do you think want to kill George Bush right now?
Yeah.
How many people wanted to kill Clinton? I mean, every president has people gunning for them. So when these kind of things happen, particularly under the circumstances that they happen in Dallas, it's not unusual for people to think, well, there might be some greater force at work here, because, you know,
well, you spoke to the problems that our country has been through and the turmoil since the Kennedy assassination, and I think that's what's really so wounding about this, because we can sit back and we can speculate on how different our country would have been had he lived. You know,
oh, sure. You're exactly right. The root of it is not so much the Kennedy assassination per se. It's explaining everything that came after.
Yeah.
You know, why did everything go so wrong? Well, yeah, the Kennedy assassination was sort of a parting of the ways, and we could have gone one way and we went another. And this was as a result of Kennedy being gunned down, I think. We've never regained that sense of optimism and self-confidence and hope for the future that we had at that moment in the early 60s.
Yeah.
And
that's the real tragedy.
Conspiracies are really an effort, I think, to explain how everything went so wrong and to tie it all together in a way that one can get one's head around. And now Mailer's great contribution to this whole thing is through his intimate study of Oswald's character, which I think provides, you know, a good sort of counter-narrative to the conspiracies. I mean, we all sort of want to understand the world in terms of story and narrative, and it's difficult when something is of such huge magnitude as this happens, and there's no story to tell. If it's just some guy who just walked to work one day with a gun and changed the course of history, well,
right.
That's a hard thing to get your head around.
Yeah, yeah.
But Oswald, if you understand his character, is something you can get your head around. It may be painful and disgusting and distasteful to think that such a person could do this kind of thing, but it's understandable, whereas I think the way that Oswald's been depicted in so many movies and books is mistaken, and it's difficult to understand how such a person could have carried this out.
Yeah, yeah, it's unimaginable. But I look at Oswald's ghost, I look at the film you did on Patty Hearst, is there kind of a common theme that you like to explore? What kinds of stories are you generally attracted to?
Well, you know, I've been at this a long time, so it's not such a conscious effort to sort of delve into certain things, but I certainly, now looking back, there are themes that are emerging in all my films, and I think one of them is the sort of this fuzzy area between fantasy and reality that we all sort of inhabit. We all sort of create our own reality,
mm-hmm.
part fantasy and part reality. And this really forms our perception of the world. And I think our perception of the world is far more has far greater impact on things and how we go about our lives, both as individuals and societies, than the reality. So telling a story about, I mean, I'm glad there are documentary filmmakers that go out there and talk about reality. I'm really interested in perceptions of reality.
Sure.
And conspiracy theories are wonderful windows into perceptions of reality. I mean, almost every culture, every country, every subculture and within countries has their conspiracy theories. And these are, I mean, there's plenty going on now you could come to mind. But and these have a great impact on, I mean, people fight wars and civilizations rise and fall on conspiracy theories.
That's very true.
Did you always know that the documentary form was where you wanted to work and where you wanted to explore these themes, pretty like the ideal medium to explore these kinds of things?
No. I mean, I actually, when I first started getting into film, I wanted to do dramatic films. And I still, I don't watch a lot of documentaries. I'm mostly, you know, for inspiration, I watch dramatic films.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, I originally wanted to be a cinematographer, which is kind of funny considering I spend so much time dealing with archival footage now. But my dad was a historian, so, you know, I guess even though I fled from academia as far as I could, the apple didn't
right.
fall so far from the tree in the end.
Sure, sure. So Oswald's Ghost, it airs on PBS, is it this Sunday or this Monday?
It's Monday at 9 p.m., yeah.
And then it releases on DVD...
It'll, at the same time, yeah.
The same time.
Yeah.
It is a fantastic film. And
thanks so much.
I urge everyone to go out there and pick it up or watch it on PBS when it airs. And thank you so much for being on our show tonight. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you.
Yeah. Great, I enjoyed it. Thanks
thank
a lot for having
much.
Me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye
okay.
now.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. That is Robert Stone, director of the new documentary film Oswald's Ghost. Fascinating stuff.
Yes, it is.
Personally, for me, I mean, I think that JFK is one of the great American films, but I'm very open to saying it could be that simple. It could be Oswald acting alone. That's what's so infuriating. You know, it's these unanswered questions.
Right, and they're unanswered questions, I think, for the rest of our lifetime. Do we have time to talk, or is our next guest...
Sure, we get a little bit of time.
Okay, when this, I guess it was in 2003, I guess it was, would it have been the 40th anniversary of his assassination?
Yes.
David Brooks of the New York Times, who was always on every Friday on NewsHour on PBS, I don't always agree with him, because he's very conservative, but he wrote, he made a timeline in his editorial of what
right.
would happen if he was not assassinated, and it was very interesting. Do you know who never becomes president in that timeline? Richard Nixon. We never
yeah.
hear from him again.
Well, that's look no further than another fantastic Oliver Stone movie. Look at Nixon.
Yeah.
I mean, and he even expresses it in that film. He
yeah.
understands his tragedy. He
yeah.
says, my success in this life has been over the bodies of two dead brothers.
Yes, he's absolutely right, and that's a very good point he makes in that film. The other thing that he says, and sort of that what Mr. Stone was saying too, is that he said the reason for the conspiracy theory, at least at first, was that people could not accept, the majority of the population just could not accept that this guy, this frail little man, acted alone,
yes.
brought down such a great figure.
And look, I think it's also important, maybe I gave him the wrong impression, but obviously he made it clear that he's not trying to debunk all the conspiracy theories.
Right.
He's just saying that it's he came to the conclusion that it's perfectly reasonable that Oswald killed Kennedy alone. And I think that it is. But watching a movie like JFK, there's just so much. I mean,
oh, yeah.
There's too much, you know, for there not to be some meat there. I mean, something there.
Yeah.
You know, do you agree?
Oh, yeah. It's a good film, and I even think, like, Nixon to a lesser extent. Actually, when Stone, I think, focuses on the politics, and especially the 60s, he's at his absolute best.
Right.
He really, that's his era, he understands that. But I think there's something, I see something new and good in those films every time I watch them.
See, I personally am crazy about JFK. And I know that it's over the top, it's overblown, it's Oliver Stone's
style. But that's Oliver Stone!
It's not really a subject that's open to subtlety in the first place. Because it is the day, it is the incident that forever changed our country.
Yeah, oh yeah.
But
everyone
knows
where they were that day.
the real reason why I love JFK, beyond the technical brilliance of it and the editing bravado and its amazing piece of work, is because it's very positive in a way. And I think it's one of the most patriotic movies I've seen. It says, this is your government. You know, it belongs to you.
Mm-hmm.
These people serve you. So become more active in it, you know. And I think it really appealed to the youth in this country.
Oh, it did.
In 91 when it came out. It certainly inspired me to actually, you know, read, you know, be informed.
No, you're absolutely right. It was, you know, and it was something, it was before Stone, I think he does his, when he lets the film speak for itself, he's priceless. Sometimes he goes over the top. I think with Natural Born Killers, when he started to do the press for that, he was getting all defensive in interviews. But no, when he JFK.
Well, it has to be hard. You're attacked throughout your entire career.
Oh, I know. I think, you know, if I was him, just let the film. The film is all you need to put out there sometimes. And JFK, like you said, it's a masterpiece. Not only technical brilliance. It's what you said. It's a film that this is your government. You have to be part of it. He says in that movie what. A lot of documentaries fail to get across.
In that
ethos of yes, this is your government. Get involved.
But Oswald's Ghost does come across the tremendous loss we suffered, and the means that we've chosen to deal with that loss. And so I, it's a very important film, very enlightening and thought provoking. And just when you thought you couldn't see anything new about the JFK assassination, he comes up with and I didn't get to ask him about this, but footage that you've never seen.
Right.
The police communication on the day of the assassination that you've never heard.
Mm-hmm.
These are tapes that, how were they lost for 40 years? How have they been missing for 40 years?
Yeah, you're right.
You know, but somehow they have been. And he just unearthed them. And while it's not like, it's not a missing link or a missing piece or a clue or something, it is haunting because it's a piece of history that he is just now providing to us.
Right.
You know, and that we haven't been able to get before. But it's a great movie. Monday on PBS, and I believe it comes out on DVD on Tuesday, is the release date for it. Jerry, you know we love film composers.
Right.
Howard Shore, John Ottman, help me out, Mark Isham, Mark.
Michael, those are all these guys that we've had on. The great.
Yeah, and the Brian Tyler we have next week, who scored the new Rambo picture.
Right. I mean, these are just great composers we have on.
I go to sleep every night to the Rambo score. I don't know if you're aware of that.
I did not know that. I had no idea. Do you ask yourself before you go to sleep, will we be allowed to win this time?
Yes. I'm very tortured when I go to sleep. At Movie Geeks United, we love film composers, and we are so thrilled to be welcoming our next guest tonight. At the age of 34, our next guest has built an impressive and versatile resume, writing scores for both the big and small screens. He's won a Movie Music and Cine Music Award for his powerful contribution to Clive Barker's Saint Center, Best Original Score from the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences for his work on Steven Spielberg's Medal of Honor Rising Sun video game, an Emmy nomination for the hit TV series Supernatural, and a Grammy for Best Latin Rock Alternative Album in 2004. Of his work in Steven Spielberg's Medal of Honor, critic James Southall of Movie Wave exclaimed, "It puts most modern film music to shame." His latest work can be heard on the big screen in this season's smash hit, Alvin and the Chipmunks, and it is a really delightful score, too. It is our great pleasure to welcome to the program Mr. Christopher Lennertz. Christopher, are you with us?
I am with us.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Well, thanks for having me.
I love the score for Alvin and the Chipmunks. I've been living with it for the past week, and it's just I've been in a better mood for the past week because I've been living with this terrific music.
Thank you.
I want to know,
would you be happy?
Yeah, when did you first fall in love with music and know that it was your passion in life?
Well, music in general, I fell in love with at a very early age. I think I started playing trumpet at about 9 years old. But even before that, my grandfather was a singer before he went into World War II professionally, and then he continued to sing beyond that. So I kind of grew up, you know, even as, you know, as young as, you know, 5, 6 years old, I remember him, you know, singing along with Sinatra records, and he would always sing at all the weddings, you know, in our family. And so I definitely had a, you know, had a very a strong love of music from the very beginning. But then it was probably, you know, 9 or 10 years old. I grew up spending most of my time in the Boston area. I was born north of Boston, and so I, you know, I had the privilege of spending every summer taking multiple trips to the Boston Commons and the Hat Shell and seeing John Williams conduct, you know, both his music as well as the other, you know, classics and things like that. So, I mean, I just remember so vividly, you know, sitting on a picnic blanket with my family and just hearing them do Raiders or Jaws or Close Encounters and, you know,
That's heaven.
Away.
That is
that's heaven.
Heaven
right there. Exactly. I understand that you're also influenced by Leonard Bernstein.
Well, he was actually born in Lawrence, Massachusetts, which is right next to Methuen, where I was born. And so I remember my mom and dad sort of singing Maria and
right.
and the When You're a Jet song from West Side Story and all this kind of stuff, because they were so he was such an icon in that area because he was sort of the hometown, you know, hero in the music side of things from that side of the world. So absolutely, I would say I definitely had a strong influence of his then, and then once I got to college, I went to USC, and I did about 3 major film analysis projects, and 2 of the 3 were actually done on his pieces. One was the Chichester Psalms, and the other one was Symphonic Dance of a West Side Story. So I've always had a love of him, and I feel like he's sort of, other than of course Copland, which is very, you know, sort of Americana, I think, as far
very
as
much.
As far as an American classical orchestra composer, you know, and someone who fuses jazz and orchestra and all this kind of stuff. I don't think anyone did it better than Bernstein did.
Yeah, so you knew from a young age that film composing kind of, I mean, it turned you on in a way. And did you get a sense of escape from it? What about that music spoke to you?
Well, I think for me, you know, I'm sure my mom and dad, much to their dismay at the very beginning, would always sort of classify me as a, you know, sort of the dreamer space cadet. You know,
sure.
I was usually playing with some sort of Star Wars figure in some sort of fort that I built in my backyard. And, you know, and for me, you know, to be able to be transformed to a, you know, or transported to a place that was in your imagination or on the screen, that's something larger than life, something that can take you from reality into, you know, whether it be the stars or into the past or, you know, into King Arthur's court. The amazing opportunity for music to be able to transport you like that, it was sort of amazing. I mean, it's almost like having your own personal, you know, time machine.
Yeah. Yeah, but then again, the role of a film composer, it's kind of elusive to a lot of people. How do you define what a film composer does? What your job is?
Well, I mean, not only is it elusive. I mean, you know, coming out of even high school, I don't think anyone in my little hometown of Easton, Pennsylvania, where I went to high school, I don't think they even, that was a real job. quite honestly. So you know, for me. You know, I from the very early age, like I said, with the John Williams influence and things like that, I always felt like the stuff on screen was very, you know, it was very concrete. It was there, you could see it. But there was the music actually, I think, is what really brings the emotion to a scene or a story or a place. And I feel like one of the things that I think music can accomplish the most, and it is sort of elusive. You know, I can't tell you how many movies, because my mom always sort of, she'll watch a film with me, and I know she's struggling, and I'll say, you know, God, wasn't that music amazing? And she'll always say, there was music? Really? You know? And I said, but were you crying at the end? And she said, yeah. And I said, well, then it was there, and it did its job.
Yeah, yeah. Because there are all kinds of composers out there, but it's something that interests me because apparently we've heard from other composers that we've had on the show, some write their music kind of so that it sounds good on the CD, and that doesn't necessarily serve the picture's best interest.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
I think there's a difference. You know, if you want, you know, that one of the reasons that there are both colossal flops and sorry about the car.
That's all right. be careful on the road there. Right?
Exactly. Now I think there's both colossal flops and humongous successes. You know, when you look at, like, for example, artists or rock musicians who come into film scoring.
Right.
And I think so much of that has to do with not the fact that they're good musicians or not, but whether they're good dramatists. And I think that's one of the reasons that Danny Elfman is such a fantastic composer. Not that many other rock stars or musicians or classical musicians or whatever aren't wonderful musicians, but Danny's a great dramatist, and I think that's one of the reasons he's been successful where so many others have failed, is because he really gets the idea of telling a story first and foremost. That's
sure.
not to say the music doesn't sound great on a CD, but that wasn't his primary goal. That was a secondary
goal, yeah.
You know?
And I know you work in all fields of music. I mean, there's film, there's television, and now there's video games. That opens up a whole new world for the composer. But is it essentially the same process? Or do they differ at all in terms of technique or process?
The implementation and sort of the construction of the pieces of the whole and their function differs, but
right.
the idea of writing exciting music to make a chase scene doesn't differ at all. I mean, I would say that's almost identical, whether it be for a small screen, the big screen, or a video game. I think it's just the way the pieces work within the structure of the story. Obviously, video games are a lot more open-ended because, you know, the player's experience and expertise will change the pacing of
uh-huh.
the story,
uh-huh.
whereas when a character turns the corner and runs down the street, that's going to be locked in stone once the movie's done.
Right.
So I think it's more of a construction aspect.
Yeah, I know that some composers like to start on a project. Ideally, they'd like to see a script, and some of them can't work from a script. They just want to wait until they see a first cut. How early do you like to be involved in a project?
I really like to be involved as early as possible. I love reading scripts. I won't necessarily write full pieces of music, but from a script I can start thinking about instrumentation. I can
uh-huh.
start thinking about pacing and things like that. And you know, especially in this day and age with post-production schedules being so quick and things like that, I'll take any extra time I can get to conceptualize. You know, when you think of phenomenal pieces of music, you know, whether it be an Aaron Copland symphony, you know, that he may have spent 2 years on one symphony, or whether it be a Beatles record, they may have spent a year recording Abbey Road or the White Album, you know what I mean? And then you're stuck here, and then a film composer is asked to write, you know, a 60-minute, 80-minute score in 4 or 5 weeks. Well, you know, that's a pretty tight schedule to become, you know, truly creative. So if they can give me a script a year before and I can start thinking about ideas, it's a wonderful sort of head start.
Yeah. Yeah, I would think so. But in terms of your process, tell me about, let's take Alvin and the Chipmunks. You watch a cut of the film and what starts coming to you? Do you hear a particular instrument? How do you start building that musical voice?
Well, with Alvin, I did get a script first. The film had been sort of shot, but was being edited, and it was in you know, very early stages of just sort of assembling it. So I did get a script first, and at that point I sat down with the director and started just throwing out things like ideas. One of the early ideas we had, well, you know, I'll say, all right, well, things start off in a forest. So, you know, and they start off in a Christmas tree. And, you know, and so I said, you know, what... Well, not to be literal, but to be in an abstract sense, what can we do to sort of tip our hat to the fact that you know, hey, this is, these are, you know, as much as this is a story about three orphans and their dad, it is also a story about, you know, something a little more fantastical than that, and that the fact that they're animals. And so, you know, we kind of came up with the idea of using a lot of wooden percussion, things like, you know, like marimbas and xylophones and things like that.
Yeah.
But then we also kind of came up with this idea of, you know, of what about triangles, for example, were something that the director mentioned a couple of pieces that he liked, and pieces of music, you know, that he had heard. And I said, okay, well, one of the things that all these pieces have in common is the use of a triangle. And he said, well, I think I like it because it reminds me of pine needle hitting the grass.
Yes.
And so we said, okay, well, what if we build percussive grooves around wooden percussion and triangles? And eventually I ended up, you know, processing the triangles and putting them backwards and changing some things around to kind of give them a little more of a contemporary feel. But that's basically where we came from. You know, so in one sense, we did a lot of that conceptualizing before I ever got a cut of the film. And I wrote little pieces of music probably back in August, where I was just handing things over to him and saying, hey, what do you think of this? And they were starting to edit, and they'd throw it in, and they liked the way some things were playing. You know, and then once we got past the instrumentation aspects, we knew it was going to be these kind of things. We knew that we were also going to involve the guitar because the character of Dave, played by Jason, he is the songwriter, so we wanted to have a little contemporary feel in there. And then we knew that obviously there was going to be a big use of lush orchestra and strings because they really wanted the heart. They wanted it to be a full-on, you know, Hollywood family film. So by the time I even got a first cut of the film, you know, maybe a month after I read the script, I had already written, you know, four or five pieces, but not the pitch, that just sort of had the vibe.
Right.
You know?
But I would think that the timing aspect of it would be incredibly difficult, because listening to the CD, you know, the Dave's theme, it's very beautiful and very delicate, but you have 40 seconds to establish it. Is that a particular challenge?
It is. I think one of the things that we, both the Dave's theme and the main Chipmunks theme, which is the long sort of sweeping thing that comes in the main title section, you know, one of the things that Tim Hill, the director, wanted, and the Bagdasarians, who, you know, whose dad created the Chipmunks, was they said, look, the songs are so catchy, and the songs, immediately, when you know, the Christmas song, for example, you know, everyone from the age of, you know, from the age of 20 to 60 or 80 remembers those songs, and they both said, you know, we want the score to have that kind of recognition. And we don't want a long, eight-measure-long theme that takes 2 minutes to then develop. You know, they said, what we really love are these simple themes that will then resound, and we can bring back throughout the course of the movie. So by the time you leave the theater, you also have that in your head. You're sort of sitting there with that, you know, playing around and around in your mind.
Yeah. And I would think, too, that the different genres, and you've worked in all kinds of different genres, action and comedy and family. Is comedy particularly tricky? Because it obviously needs to be light, but it can't be jokey, or it kind of distracts from what's on screen, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially lately, I think, you know, there was a lot more, you know, you could write a lot more funny music.
Right.
In the older styles of, you know, in the golden era of Hollywood, you could probably get away with more jokey music. It's really, the trend is not for that. And I think
it competes for what's on the screen, doesn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, ideally you just want to enhance. And I think, I actually think comedy is probably the hardest music to write. And I probably never put my finger on that originally, but then I had the, you know, amazing good fortune of being able to study with Elmer Bernstein when I was in school, and nobody did comedy better than Elmer.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I hear sirens in the background. Are you in a nice area? Are you doing all right?
I'm in a fine area, actually. I'm just in a beautiful neighborhood here in LA.
Worried for you. What do you think about temp scoring? Are you generally opposed to it? Is it useful?
I think, you know, it's pros and cons. I don't think it's going anywhere, so I don't fight it more than I don't fight it. But at the same time, what I try to do is I try to have a conversation with my directors as early as possible to say, what is it about the temp you like? Not in terms of the musicality, but what is it, the instrumentation? Is it the pacing? Uh-huh. Is it the tone? Is it a certain level of happiness or a certain level of heroicism? But let's try not to get so attached to the actual piece, but try to figure out what is it about the piece that makes you feel like it's in the right direction. And then the other thing I try to do as often as possible is advise them to, hey, you know what? Obviously for test screenings, you need to have temp music in there. So that's fine, but can we use temp music only judiciously in the spots that really need it? And then is it possible also, you know, which actually I did in Alvin, I actually ended up writing two or three, you know, pieces solely on synths to begin with that they ended up using in the previews. And so while they were doing all their studio testing and everything like that, there was already five or six pieces of music of mine in the film.
Oh, okay.
So that obviously helps because that piece of music the general style of music that was when Dave was throwing out instruments and was sort of giving up on his music career with that sort of fast-paced thing with all the triangles, that was the pieces I had written not to picture, and they actually ended up using that in the temp.
Right.
And so
right.
I ended up just sort of massaging it to fit the picture later on.
When you work with a director, do the best directors generally have a strong musical sense, would you say, or can they express to you what they want? Do they do it through just the feel of it, or how does that communication work?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a situation where if the director knows too much about music, sometimes it can actually hinder the process because they'll get hung up on things that are non-dramatic. And I think the best the director can do for me is to look at a scene and not say, oh, this should be full of percussion and lots of fast snare drums and flute glisses and things like that. I would rather have her look at me and just go, I want this to feel heroic, or I want this to feel tragic.
Right.
Because that, to me, that's what this is all about. And that will lead me on a more true direction of doing what I do, which is, you know, I truly think that, you know, the film composer's job as opposed to a traditional composer's job is to be a storyteller. Not uh-huh. merely to write notes on a page that please the ear, but you have to tell this story. And I think that's the number one job. And so by giving me instructions that are drama related and story related, that's how we're going to get to the proper piece of music quickest.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I know that everyone's already seen this Alvin and the Chipmunks at the theaters. Obviously, it's a huge smash
yeah,
hit
it's
movie.
Bigger than any of us even thought it was going to be.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's terrific.
Yeah, I'm
but
thrilled.
Is it available in stores now as well, your soundtrack?
It is not yet.
Okay.
The soundtrack, you mean?
Your score, yes, sir.
Yeah, no, the score will probably be out. The record with the songs is out already, and the score will probably be released to coincide with the DVD release.
Okay. It is a fantastic score, and it's
oh,
a real
you.
Delight. And what's coming up next for you? I see you have looks like you have another comedy on the horizon next month.
I do have
month.
Another comedy on the horizon, and this one actually is very much in the Elmer Bernstein realm of doing things. It's a parody called Meet the Spartans,
yes.
which is an absolute 100% over-the-top parody of movies like 300 and things
Gladiator,
like that.
Gladiator, yeah,
Gladiator, all this stuff. And you'll I'm sure they'll send you the promo of the score, and I defy you to find a comedic moment in it. It is absolutely the straight man from start to finish. We had a 94-piece orchestra and 80-voice choir we recorded in Belgrade. And it's just monstrous. Plus we had tons of, you know, Middle Eastern instruments and soloists, and it's absolutely over the top. My first 2 years out of college I worked for Basil Polidorus, which was an amazing And so I definitely use his humongous horn writing Conan style,
yeah.
You know, over the topness to play the comedy, because the funny part is, you know, there'll be this huge battle scene, and then at the very end, you know, Paris Hilton will walk on screen, or instead of, you know, defeating, you know, Xerxes, the captain will fall into the pit of death accidentally. So there's all these big moments where I actually take the music very, very seriously and build up to the joke.
You know, that makes perfect sense, because in order for those films to work, they have to play it deadly seriously. You know, they have to invest as much as they would in a high drama, you know, to make those jokes
absolutely.
Pay off. Well, I can't wait for that. And you are more than welcome to come back on our show anytime. Anytime you have a new score that you'd like to discuss, we'll be pleased to have you.
Oh, absolutely. And where are you guys broadcasting from, may I ask?
Different areas,
shows,
actually.
Different areas.
This show is available to a global audience. We have listeners as far away as Australia and the UK, but you know, I am based out of Florida, and Jerry is based out of Maryland. So it's modern technology.
Yeah, modern technology at its
awesome.
Best.
But please come back and join us sometime in the future. It's been a real pleasure.
I'd love to. And did I hear you guys have Brian on next week?
We do. We have him on next Wednesday. Yes, sir.
Excellent. Well, I just heard AVP, and just to put it out there, he's fantastic, and that score. I listened to it on iTunes yesterday, and it's amazing. We're old friends, and I actually am blown away by that score. So give him a quick hello from me.
We will.
Thank you so much. It's been great fun talking to you.
Thanks, guys. You guys take care.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye.
That is Christopher Lennertz, the composer of Alvin and the Chipmunks. There's something about composers.
It is.
It's infectious to me. And I find that, like, when I watch behind the scenes, I'm such a dork. When I watch behind the scenes stuff, of, like the making of movies, whenever it gets to the part where they're composing the film, and you see the director watching it for the first time with music, and
mm-hmm.
tears well up in their eyes, because the music is like that final ingredient that makes it come alive.
Yeah, the music is the music many times is what makes it work.
Because music is so immediate.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
you hear a bar of your favorite song, and it gets to your heart like just like that.
Oh, definitely.
The power of music.
If you watch watch a trailer and they use a favorite piece of music, your eyes will water. I don't care who you are. I mean, you know, it will do the job.
Exactly.
Thank you, Steph, for saying that dorks unite, okay?
Well, we love our chat room.
Yeah,
even
we do.
Call
our chat
dorks,
room has been, we've gone from the, like, various conspiracy theories on the Kennedy assassination to Alvin and the Chipmunks, who's who.
What kind of music embodies a rodent? Thank you, Eric. I forgot to ask that question, but man, what a talented guy!
Absolutely.
And he composes such a different variety of music; it's just amazing to me. But we'll have another film composer on Wednesday, the composer of Alien vs. Predator and the new Rambo flick. And we're trying our best to get Sylvester Stallone on the show.
We really want to get him on. We have to get him on.
So all of our listeners out there, just stay posted to your blogs and. Hopefully sometime soon you'll see that we've just booked Stallone and you can stand up and cheer because we will be doing the same.
Definitely.
But join us on Sunday night. We got a great show, Golden Globes night, which the ceremony is canceled.
It's going to be like a news conference, I guess, for an hour, right?
Yeah, we're going to discuss that, and we're going to welcome some guests as well. There may be some last-minute guest additions as well, but right now we're planning on a kind of reunion of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest cast.
Also, remind, you're interviewing Dolph Lundgren on Friday.
Dolph Lundgren on Friday at 1:30.
What time will that be for people who can listen?
1:30 p.m. Eastern.
Okay.
We're part of a press junket, and we're already receiving emails. People are submitting questions to us already.
How long will you be interviewing him for? How long?
Very briefly. It's going to be like 15 minutes.
Okay, folks, get the questions. We want hard-hitting questions.
But it's going to be a great one. And we thank everyone out there in the chat room for joining us tonight. And we will see you on the next episode.
All right. Thank you, everyone. Good night.
Bye. Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.